Hello and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast with me, Ariane Morrissey. My guest this week works day in, day out on a question that will be central to deploying new green fuels in shipping. How can we bunker those fuels on ships safely and efficiently? Stephen Gallagher is technical advisor at SGMF, an organization known for its LNG bunkering guidelines, which were launched in their first version in 2016 and have since become a global reference. But with an evolving fuel landscape, SGMF has evolved too. The organization has expanded its scope to new fuels and just a few weeks ago launched its new bunkering guidelines for ammonia and methanol. And that is in addition to its contributions at IMO and other international standards organizations and its work on crew training, which I'm also looking forward to discussing in this episode. Welcome to the podcast, Stephen.
Thanks very much. It's a real pleasure to be here representing SGMF.
Pleasure to have you. And I guess, first of all, why did you decide to develop and release those bunkering guidelines for ammonia and methanol at this specific moment in time? Does that signal that the maritime industry is perhaps entering a new, more practical stage in the transition to new fuels?
Yeah, I definitely think this is indeed a signal to the industry kind of entering a more practical stage with the alternative fuels, where the theoretical is now being followed with implementation. People are actually starting to build these vessels. There are vessels on the water. So there's a pressing need really for industry stakeholders, whether they're ship owners, operators or fuel suppliers, to kind of have robust, safe, consistent guidelines that can support the uptake of these fuels. So from SGMF's point of view, that was where we felt that we could facilitate that transition based on our existing guidelines and to give these solid foundations onto the next best practices. So I can maybe talk a little bit about how we approach those fuels in this. So we kind of look at a five pillar approach, or five questions is how we look at them. It's how we looked at LNG. So it's the same approach we're using for ammonia, methanol, and hopefully hydrogen at some point. So the five questions really are, is it worthwhile? Can I bunker it? How does it work for the ship and the engine room? Does it work in the engine? Do I need, or is there any post-treatment? And we're trying to answer those questions at SGMF. So that's where we come in with our guidelines, our studies, our projects, to try and tick some boxes to hopefully at some point answer all five questions for each fuel type, to give owners and operators and suppliers the chance to just evaluate that impartial data, basically.
Is this a response to specific demand from the industry for those guidelines to be issued?
Yeah, from our members. So we are a membership-based organisation. So we're driven by our members, which is 150-odd members from across the chain. So we have engine manufacturers, fuel suppliers, owners, operators, training organisations, really quite a varied membership group. And they've driven us to this. They're starting to look at the alternative fuels, build vessels, look at training, look at competency, and that's where then they want some guidance and how we can implement that. So that's where we kind of, again, come into the question to bring them all around the table, create working groups, create focus groups, and really try to understand what is it the operators or owners are looking for, whether we can do it within our membership or whether we have to look outside our membership and bring in experts. That's where we feel we facilitate that, those conversations, to then produce kind of hard versions of documents that people can use and utilize.
Obviously, SGMF has experience developing bunkering guidelines for LNG. What was different this time with ammonia and methanol? Were there any lessons from the LNG experience that you were able to translate or apply into the new guidelines?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, LNG was kind of integral. It was a really important learning experience for us. SGMF started in 2013, and by 2016, we released the first bunkering guidelines. Now we're on version 3 of those LNG bunkering guidelines, and we do see that with the other fuels as well. This isn't a set in stone document. It's something that's going to be developed and be live over a number of years as lessons learned come in. But in developing the new guidelines for methanol and ammonia, it was important to ensure consistency and a structured approach, regardless of the fuels, because we do expect that at some point there'll be multi-fuel fleets. So one operator with different fueled vessels, which means potentially managers that are going to be managing different fueled vessels, crew that might have to transfer between different vessels. So having some consistent terminology, bunker management plan, have some significant changes to any of our bunker management procedures would be a real difficult thing to manage for an operator or owner. So having that structured approach and then taking into consideration the specific characteristics of each fuel. So instead of changing the approach, we just change the segment within that approach to try and give some follow through. So for example, the safety zone. So safety zone is an area around the bunker manifold, which is only present during a bunkering operation. For LNG, in part, that's determined by the lower flammable limit of a leak. So if there's a leak, we're determining the dispersion and we use the lower flammable limit to pinpoint where that safety zone goes. But for ammonia, that's different. It's going to be the toxicity. So we've looked at toxicity as being the principal characteristic that we need to look at. So instead of the flammability limit, we use the AEGL acute exposure limits for determining that safety zone. So we're using the same process. We're looking at it from the same point of view, but it has a unique characteristic. So we're using that characteristic to kind of backfeed into some of the LNG experiences and where that's came from. So the important core lesson really is that we've carried forward is the importance of safety for the stakeholder collaboration to ensure that everyone evolves responsibly. So that is the follow through and ensuring some consistency, I think, is really, really key.
Now, you talk about the importance of safety. Obviously, ammonia, methanol have completely different properties and characteristics and come with different safety challenges. Could you share perhaps a couple of headlines from the new guidelines? What kind of recommendations do you include to address those safety risks?
Yeah, I mean, if we start, again, kind of looking at the safety zone one, we kind of talk about that a little bit there, where we're taking the characteristic of ammonia in comparison to the principal characteristic of LNG, which is the flammability, ammonia is the toxicity. In the working groups for methanol, obviously methanol has a toxic trait as well, but when we determined the toxicity versus the flammability level, the principal characteristic in a leak scenario was, again, the flammability level. So that's where we looked at the flammability as being determining the safety zone. But then we still do give guidance within the methanol bunkering guidelines for the toxic exposure as well. So we have specific PPE requirements around the risk. So risk of splash, risk of exposure to methanol requires different levels of PPE. We, of course, always stress that when designing and building these vessels, PPE is the last resort. They should be designed in a way where you're using hierarchy of controls, where potential scenarios where that may happen or there may be exposure to crew are designed out way in advance so that we're not relying on PPE for the seafarers.
There are understandably quite a few questions and concerns in the industry about the safety of new fuels. And just to illustrate that, perhaps, there was a survey released recently by the Mærsk Mc-Kinney Møller Center for Zero Carbon Shipping that revealed that 59% of seafarers and ashore workers would be willing to work with ammonia, which leaves about 41% who are either unsure or would say no. So do you think your guidelines can help alleviate some of those concerns for people who will have to work with those fuels in their day-to-day job?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm an ex-seafarer, so I was at sea for a number of years, and I think their concerns are valid. And the figures you mentioned underscore the need, really, for effective communication and training. So our guidelines are designed to address the concerns by setting clear safety standards, procedures and best practices, but they need to get to the seafarers. So our membership, we push them to give these guidelines, get them on board the vessels, get them involved in these conversations, because these really do provide technical foundation to ensure that people handling these fuels, whether on the ship or even in port facilities, really understand what to do safely. It's really critical that owners and operators engage with seafarers. Again, because I'm an ex-seafarer, I'm really quite passionate about getting seafarers' input into this process. And owners really need to be transparent about their decision-making processes. And as we said before about the hierarchy of control, owners and operators and designers are doing it. They're looking at designing out potential scenarios. So if you're not sharing that with the seafarer, how have you come to make that decision? Then, of course, there's a bit of perception like, why? I don't know why they've done that. Whereas actually, in reality, they've probably designed out or engineered out a potential safety issue. So by sharing that with the seafarers, they can understand how actually they are in a safe environment or they have been considered within that process. So getting that consideration across really plays a key role in confidence levels on board the vessel and ensuring the seafarers are not only aware of the measures taken, but also they feel assured that those measures were valid and valid. So having that training and competency and getting them involved in these conversations early is really important. I attend a lot of conferences and Seafarers is usually mentioned. Seafarers are mentioned maybe once or twice during the day, but not a lot. So it's something we really, really want to push is, you know, get seafarers involved in these conversations. It's really important. They're going to be operating the vessels. They're going to be the ones that are exposed to potential hazards that they need to be aware of and understand that they are in a place of safety.
So in your view, the moment to involve seafarers in those conversations and to start training is now, is it correct?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I've been part of new build projects where they do get some seafarers involved in the builds. They tend to send them out to the shipyard to get experience and the handover and delivery. But even now, if owners and operators are starting to consider other fuels, it's important to maybe start some awareness training or consideration training or share documentation about different projects that are underway and really engage that way. A small bit of conversation with the seafarer goes a long way to alleviate any concerns and fears. I think it's they're on their day-to-day. They understand how the ships work. They understand what they need to do on their day-to-day job. Now we're changing the fuel type. That adds another thing to their day-to-day job. So getting them to understand what that actually entails is really important. For example, if we talk about methanol, all seafarers are trained firefighters. So they have their firefighting training. They have to renew that every 3 years in their short courses. Really amazing bit of training that's done there. When we start to look at methanol, for example, if you were to have a pool of methanol in daylight and it was on fire, the flame would almost be invisible. It'd be really, really tough to see. And the only smoke or anything you would see is potentially from other sources of ignition around it. So having the seafarers be aware of that potential scenario where if they're going onto a firefighting situation that they could potentially walk into a pool fire is really a credible risk. So they need to be aware of that if they're working on a methanol ship, that they use their thermal imaging cameras or they use other methods to detect, whether it's flame detectors or smoke detectors, to determine whether they're walking into this sort of scenario. It's really important. So having that really ingrained into the seafarers and they understand, they're confident that they know how to fight these fires is really important.
SGMF is directly involved in crew training. So I wondered, are you seeing more demand for training with the arrival imminently of new fuels?
Yeah, so we don't give training ourselves. We do develop training and competency guidelines, which go over kind of manage, do, assist profiles. So we will give recommendations in excess of STCW requirements. So STCW provide minimum standards for training, and it's expected that the owners, operators go in excess of that. So our guidelines come in there where we kind of talk more about the specifics. At the minute, it's just on LNG. So we talk about the specifics in there and we detail the knowledge, the underpinning knowledge they require to assist, to manage, to do. So we go through that in a matrix style. And our intention is to start developing guidelines such as that so that training organizations that are members or non-members can use those guidelines to develop model courses in addition. We are also involved in, obviously we have a consultative status at IMO, so we'll be taking part in the STCW changes that are coming. We're going to be actively involved in the discussions there about how they're going to review the IGF training courses that are currently happening. Are they effective? Are they actually doing what they should do? Are people doing in excess? And then how are we going to integrate the other fuels, whether it's separate courses, whether it's all in one course? I think it's quite a lot of discussions to come out of that. I know there's the United Nations Just Maritime Transition are quite heavily involved in that, with the ITF and ICS are looking into that. So we're also involved in those conversations. But again, I think we're all on the same page that it's all getting the seafarers to stand where they are, understanding that this perception of risk can be lowered so they understand what they're walking into.
At the same time, actual at-sea experience with ammonia or methanol as fuel is quite limited, at least for the time being. So what's the challenge of developing those training guidelines, given that kind of limited experience at sea right now?
Again, kind of the same approach we had with the guidelines, really. There are methanol ships trading around the world trading methanol. There's ammonia ships trading around the world trading ammonia. Tapping into those resources is what we've done for our guidelines, where we're talking to fuel producers, methanol producers, ammonia producers, and getting their insights. So we've actually released an emergency preparedness or release preparedness guide, where we talked with producers of ammonia and understand how do they handle leak scenarios ashore? How do they do it in their facilities? And then using kind of a more seafarer or a more shipping background, how can we translate that into a ship type scenario? So doing that for training, I think, is going to be the best way. We're still talking about equipment that is used on a lot of these vessels. For methanol, you'll be using the nitrogen systems. Nitrogen's already on many, many ships. So expanding their knowledge into how to use it effectively for methanol. So it's just changing knowledge perception, I think. Seafarers have a huge amount of training during their cadetship. Every time they rank step, they get a huge amount of training and knowledge and the experience they gain on board the vessels. The seafarers really are in a good position and the best people to kind of feed back on what they're missing as well. So they're, you know, it's a good opportunity to get them to feedback. What are they missing in their training? And that's trying to fill these gaps.
And now, you didn't just release new bunkering guidelines in the past few months. Actually, your entire organization underwent a transformation, a rebranding. Obviously, you've expanded from LNG to now incorporate those new fuels. So what's the vision behind this? And does a multi-fuel future for shipping bring more complexity for organizations like yours?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. We've had a very, very busy 2024. Our vision is to support the maritime industry's transition to sustainable, low-carbon future by becoming key knowledge partners for multiple alternative fuels, so not just one. We understand from our membership, we understand from the industry that multi-fuel is the next step. That's kind of what's coming. It doesn't just add complexity, though. It broadens the scope for possibilities for the industry. However, it does mean we need to be a little bit more agile, continually evolving our expertise in-house, but also our resources. So we're actively engaged in discussions with ports, for instance. Now we're doing a project. We really want to get ports involved because they're going to be real key stakeholders in this. And then look at fuel producers, ammonia producers, methanol producers, hydrogen experts, bring them in to start reflect how the direction of this industry is going. So while the diversity of the fuels presents a challenge, it also gives us quite good opportunities for SGMF to remain at the forefront, kind of providing solutions, keeping this sustainable, consistent guidelines that people are already using so they can use them across each of the fuels. And that hopefully will help us facilitate a bit of a smoother transition into this kind of new era in maritime energy.
What has been the response from port actors and fuel producers that you've been engaging with, and what kind of projects are you working on in collaboration with them that we should keep an eye on in months to come?
Our activities with port authorities are really important, really integral part of the supply chain, really integral part of shipping. And they have similar concerns as the seafarers potentially, where they have a bit of a perception challenge. There's maybe uncertainty on what's going to be coming to their port. There's a lot of discussions, there's a lot of media about all the new fuels. So what we're trying to do there is just talk with them, discuss with them what their concerns are. Potentially off the back of that, there may be areas where guidance is required, or maybe it is just collaboration where we can tie partners together, actually give them the scope, a talking ground where they can talk to each other and discuss potential fuel bunkering supply scenarios, or maybe some ports have experience in different areas and we can tie those ends together. Project-wise, we are looking also into expanding our knowledge base. So we're looking at talking to hydrogen producers and understanding where do they think it's going to go for the maritime industry. What are the biggest concerns they have? Same for ammonia, same for methanol. Talking to the producers that handle these, what will be fuels, and how we can adapt that into maritime atmosphere.
And do you anticipate that methanol, ammonia, and eventually hydrogen will follow a similar trajectory or similar learning curve to LNG?
Yeah, I think so. If you look at how we've developed our guidelines so far, and like I said before, we released the first bunkering guidelines and we're already on version 3, I think it's going to be exactly the same. The reason we're on version 3 is lessons have been learned. There's more uptake of LNG as a fuel, which means there's more people bunkering it, which means we understand it better. So our requirements have potentially changed. Maybe our recommendations have got stronger. Maybe some of the recommendations earlier are not as high as they were previously. So that's where we look to adapt them in the review process. And I think the same will be for all of the alternative fuels that are coming out, where the more uptake, the more we'll understand what implications the requirements have, Not only that, but IMO are obviously setting their international regulations. So as they come out as well, there'll be learnings from there. The interim guidelines for methanol are due for review in 2025. Whether they'll be taken into full regulatory requirements or whether they'll stay interim guidelines will be based on people's experience and feeding back into IMO to say, this has worked, this hasn't worked, this is where we need changes. So I think it's important we're dynamic. I don't think it's a good idea that we stay stagnant and we set ourselves in stone. We do need to be dynamic. There is a demand for all of these fuels right now, and to push forwards will require some learnings. And let's hope that those learnings are shared and collaborated and everybody's speaking to each other, because that's the key approach.
And presumably keeping all of those guidelines for different fuels up to date is going to be quite a big task, because technology, knowledge will evolve quite quickly. So what's going to be your approach to that?
It's one of our subjects within our committees is how we're going to produce a review process. I said version 3 of LNG, when do we do version 2 of methanol and ammonia? So we're going to be looking at developing a focus group, which is purely going to be looking at how we review our documents and when are they reviewed and how do we integrate the new fuels into those documents, whether it's separate, integrated, and how that's going to look from an SGMF point of view. But our approach is really to establish a continuous review process. So they stay live, they stay active, working closely with industry experts, regulators, and most importantly, our members who are using these fuels and doing the projects and working on that. So we'll also incorporate feedback from those using guidelines in real world applications and adjust them as needed. So the collaborative and iterative process will ensure the guidelines grow alongside the industry growing, and that we continue to provide current and actionable best practices for safe, sustainable operations, keeping in front of the changing curve, because it's very, very dynamic at the minute.
Very dynamic, but are you optimistic for what comes next?
Extremely. I think there's a lot of opportunities here for new applications. We can think about things differently. These new fuels definitely give new opportunities to not only our guidelines, but to industry to progress and move forwards from potentially older practices to better practices. We're building lots of new vessels. Hopefully those lessons learned, not just in the fuel, but design of those vessels, the handling of those vessels, that is adapting as well. You see the designs of new build vessels coming out now are significantly different to how they used to be 5-10 years ago. So I think that again will progress the development of technology. As we're developing engines for these fuels, there's more knowledge coming out of that, which means we can innovate and be better and do better. You know, the best fuel you can use is the fuel you don't use at all. So, you know, there's elements to that, kind of building that into, it's not just the fuel, it's all of the other practices that you can incorporate that can be fuel efficient, fuel saving. That's where there's some key quick wins.
Stephen Gallagher, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.